I'm K2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. My name is Dick. It is time we run the TechNet, which meets every Sunday night for the last 34 years, I think it is. 34 and a fraction years. Starting in September of 1982. It's a gathering of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about their equipment and the 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. Because the TechNet's been around for 34 years, and 10 years of it are, more than 10 years of it are recorded, and you can play it back by going to, the call letters are, WA1MB, no, QRZ.com. No, all of a sudden I've forgotten the email address. It's done by Mike Perry, KC2NJI, and it's amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can play back the last 10 and a fraction years of the TechNet. This recording tonight will be on that location a few days downrange from now. There's a second website that supports the TechNet. That's done by Mike number 2, K1MJM. And that's LimarkTechNet.com is the www.LimarkTechNet.com. LIMARC is what Limarck stands for. Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club. With 10 years of TechNet recorded and 34 years of TechNet altogether, quite a few thousand hours of TechNet, obviously there's going to be some repeats. So from time to time you'll say, gee, I've heard that subject before. Well, each time we go back to a subject, there's some quite often a slightly different slant to it. There's always a little bit more information. We've received quite a few letters recently of people giving us very nice compliments about the information they're gathering, particularly on the subject of antennas. And in past years, we've occasionally had people unhappy about the fact that the subject of antennas was covered so heavily on the TechNet. Let me drop. Without a doubt, TechNet does cover antennas quite frequently, quite in depth. Like, the subject of antennas was discussed for almost a solid hour and a half last Sunday. I believe that's justified because each of the books telling you how antennas work, each of the courses you can take, even at the college masters and bachelor level, do a only mediocre job of explaining what an antenna really is and how it works. There's an awful lot of hidden information. The only way you can really get that information, in my opinion, is by a 10 or 20 year apprenticeship. I'm not a super smart guy, but I was very lucky to be in the right place at the right time. Airborne Instruments Laboratory, almost every single product they make has something to do with radar. And radar, they build radar antennas, rotary joints, waveguides, transmitters, receivers, modulators, demodulators, video processors, just power supplies, all kinds of zillions of components for the 50 years that company existed. And I worked for that company for 35 years. So I was touching antennas on a daily basis in that company, because you don't have a radar. Whether the radar is, let me drop it. Whether that radar is mounted on a ground vehicle, ground-based, airplane, no matter what, it needs an extremely high-performance antenna to perform well. At the height of their success, AIL had over 2,000 engineers, degreed engineers working for that company, and more than 1,500 for sure, during the height of the B-1B bomber program. The company had as many as 30 antenna engineers in the antenna engineering department, and about 10 of those engineers had a really deep understanding of how an antenna really works. 10 engineers out of 1,500. That's less than 1.5%. 1%. And that's a company where every single product they make needs an antenna. Gives you some idea of how difficult it is to find good antenna engineers. They're kind of a rare thing. So you work for a company like that, or you work for the Jessic Laboratory, or you work for the Wheeler Laboratory. These are two past antenna companies, and maybe even Hazeltine. You get a lot of antenna exposure. Let me drop it. So in my 35 years of exposure, that's where an awful lot of the hidden information about antennas to me came about. It wasn't by way of books or courses. Okay, we're now going to take people who sign into the TechNet by giving me their call letters, their name, and the word yes means you do have a question or a comment. Our schedule tonight will be something in the vicinity of an hour or an hour and a half of questions and answers, followed by the space report. Paul, WS2N, will be giving a space report number 245, and this is TechNet number 1645 of the series. Let me drop. Okay, so give me your call letters and your name and the word yes right now if you do have a question or a comment for the net. K2RIW listening.
WS2N, Paul, with a quick comment, right before the net. Back to you.
Okay, I'm going to take the check-ins first and go over to Paul. Anyone else to check in besides Paul? Give me your call letters and name right now.
W2YY. Joe, yes.
Very fine, Joe. Who else is there to sign in? Okay, we're taking check-ins for the TechNet right now. Is there anybody else out there? Give me your call letters and your name. If you've got, and by the way, don't worry about having a question that's too simple. There's no such thing as a dumb question on the TechNet. You don't have that kind of a judgment, if you know what I mean. So give me your call letters and name. And the word yes if you do have a question or a comment. K2RIW listening. Okay, Mabel. Okay, please give me that repeat. Repeat that call letters and name, sir.
N2CVA, Jerry.
Okay, you're going to have to squeeze the mic, wait a second, and then start talking. All I heard was something that sounded like TVA. Give me your full call letters and name, sir. K2RIW.
N2CVA, Jerry.
Okay, I heard N2. It sounded like Charlie Victor Alpha. And please give me your name, sir. K2RIW. You're going to have to squeeze the mic, wait a second, and then talk. So please repeat your name, sir. K2RIW. I'm always missing the beginning.
Jerry.
Okay, I heard Eri, and I'm going to guess that the name is Jerry. Alrighty, one last call. Anyone to check into the TechNet, give me your call letters and name right now.
N2HH, November 2, Hotel, Uniform Hotel. Yes, with a question. Andy in Queens, New York.
Very fine, Andy. Okay, Paul's got a point of order to give us. Go right ahead, Paul. WS2N. Our space report, Maven. K2RIW listening.
Yeah, this is WS2N. We'll be doing space net report 245 later. I just want to make one announcement that we're going to do a Kids Day event over at my daughter's school in Rockhockma tomorrow morning through the, probably through till 2:30. But in the morning, I know she wants to make some contact, so we set up two radios, a 2-meter radio and an HF radio as well. In the morning, we'll have some of the younger kids there. And maybe we'll do on 2 meters, probably simplex, and maybe the you know, Zeldin repeater or something. We'll just make some contact. So if anybody hears us, you know, come on back to us. And we'll be on 40 meters, 20 meters, general, probably the general portion of the band. That's usually more active. When I'm there, you know, we could go over to the extra, but it's usually more busy in the general portion of the band. So if anybody's listening tomorrow, from, let's say, 9:30 all the way till 10:30, you know, answer our QRZ. We'll be QRV at that time. Back to you then.
Okay, kids have entered the school. Tomorrow, 9:30 to 2:30. 40 and 20 meters for sure. Probably the general portion of the band. What's the call letters we should be looking for, Paul, is question number one. And when you're on 2 meters, what frequency will you be on? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, okay, we'll be on, over there, we'll go into the cell at 145.375, you know, for the repeater. But, simplex, your standard 146.520, and, that'll be it for 2 meters. And the call letter would be, my daughter's call letter, N2WIN, November 2, Whiskey, India, November. And when I'm over there, maybe we'll switch it over to, WS2M Whiskey Sierra 2 November. Or maybe both. I'd like to do it for, get two radios going just temporarily at one time. That would be a lot of fun. And what this is a communications day, really, for getting ready, preparing the kids for International Space Station contact, but later next month. So that, you know, all space things, space-related programs have been going on all year. And what you call a communications day or kids day event. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so your daughter's call letter is N2WIN, Jennifer. I am guessing that you acquired that as a past family member that had that ham call. You're going to be on 146.375, the Zeldin repeater, and also simplex 146.52. And so, I guess you're looking for people to sign in so there's somebody to talk to. And are you also looking forward to visitors at the school? And if so, which school, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
No, I don't think they'll be, you never know. They always notify the media, but probably on the day when they do the contact with the space station, if anything. So that's probably what's going to happen, but probably not tomorrow. I don't think there's going to be any visitors. But we don't need that. We have ham radio. We have plenty of people to talk to. We'll see what happens. And the reason I say that, you never know what the bands, especially HF, set up an antenna on the roof the other day, and I know that's working. We tested that, and that worked good. And if that band is dead, you know, at least we'll have 2 meters to fall back on, show them something, you know. And they have classes during the day, and each group is, you know, one group is doing phonics, another one's doing the basis of CW, another one's learning the basis of putting radio parts together, you know. they got a whole curriculum going on this thing. Back to you, sir.
When it comes to the 2 meter operation tomorrow, Paul, will you be halftime on 146.375 and halftime on simplex 146.52? And on 146.375, is that a normal 4ZPL? Over to you, Paul. I should have said 145.375. Is that a 4ZPL?
Yeah, that's our Zeldin repeater. So, yes, 136.5. And, yeah, you said something else, but, probably on that, you know, unless, you know, a lot of mobile stations get on, they, you know, you don't want to crowd the frequency, so then we would just shift over to, 146.520, you know, your standard calling frequency on Simplex. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Yeah, I think it's twice now that I gave out the wrong frequency. Not 145, not 146, it's 147.375, the other machine that's associated with this one. And right now, let's see, I guess I am hearing 147.375 on the 4ZPL and 146.52. Okay, good luck with that operation then tomorrow, Paul. And am I correct in guessing that Jennifer got that very nice set of call letters, a W-2, because you acquired a past family member's call letters? Over to you, Paul.
She wanted something that sounded good naturally, phonetically, and to W-I-N, with, you know, win at the end was pretty cool. But at the same time, she liked CW as well. She got used to it listening to me when she was a kid. So she picked that up. So, you know, it sounded good to hug back to you guys.
Thank you, Paul. Okay. The first person who signed in with a real question tonight is Joe, W2RYY. I wonder if those logarithmic mathematics are starting to make a little more sense to you, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW to be listening.
Well, good evening, Dick. I actually have an antenna question, which is right up your alley because you'll think you love antenna questions. This one has to do with a antenna called a DB201L, which is a folded monopole type of ground plane. It's actually designed as half of a what they call a folded dipole, but this is the kind of antenna that uses the top element folds over on itself and is grounded to the ground connection plate where radios go. I do have one of these, not put together, but I have one tuned a couple of years ago, and for 6 meters, and I have some specifications on it, not specifications, but measurements on it, but just discussing it might be a little interesting to some people, because I've heard some people talk previously about making, like, ground planes for 2 meters, and this might be an ideal antenna, because the idea of the thing is that since the top element is grounded, it gives you DC protection instead of being an open element, where if you take a nearby surge from a lightning strike, some of that energy could be imparted down your antenna line. This one probably tends to cancel out a great deal of that because the element itself is at a DC ground potential, the center element. Back to you, Dick.
Joe, back off a little bit on the audio. You're a little bit heavy. Good sounding audio, but a little bit heavy. You gave us a set of call letters for the design of the folded monopole antenna. W2IL or something like that, but you said it very fast. So where did you get the design from? I presume the design tells you what materials to use. Sounds to me like you've done a recent construction of this. And roughly what standing wave ratio you're getting. Back to you, Joe. K2RIW.
Well, the reason I talk fast, I try to get as much information in the time allotted as possible. That's why I talk fast.
Okay, the call letters of the originator of this folded monopole antenna. Give me those call letters again, a little bit slower.
Oh, I don't know who originated the antenna as far as design. And what you thought I heard is, what you thought I said is not what I said. I said Delta Bravo Dash 201 Lincoln. That's the model of the antenna. It's called a folded monopole antenna. It's typically used on low band, but they do make the same model for high band and UHF. Back to you.
What's the approximate price of that antenna, and where'd you buy it, Joe?
I didn't buy it. It was given to me. The antenna was originally operating on around 47 megahertz, 47.42, if I remember. It was given to me because it was taken down. And I'm sorry about if my audio sounds a little excessive. Yeah, I thought I had it adjusted properly. Anyway, this antenna, I cut down the elements to make it work very well on 6 meters. It's resonant on 52.500. But I got the measurements, what I want to compare it to the length of a quarter wave on 6 meters. That's what I think is interesting on this one. I'll give you some example. The top element cuts to 50 3/8 inches, which is 1.2795 meters. The wavelength on 52.500 is 1.4. My glasses, man. Wavelength on 52.500 free space is 1.4285 meters. So that means the top element is about 0.89566% of the a quarter wave. Now the radials is interesting because they're longer, much longer than the top element is. 73/4 inches on each radial, which is 1.7970 meters, or 125.79% of a quarter wave on 52.500 megahertz. So I'm not sure where this original design came from, but it's interesting that the top element is much shorter than a quarter wave, but the radials end up being much longer than a quarter wave. I originally tuned this thing up years and years ago. I had when I had access to a vector network analyzer, so I looked at the impedance of the antenna as well as the resonant frequency, and that's where I came by with these particular measurements and so forth to get the thing tuned right about 52.500. Back to you.
The folded monopole itself, the radiator, Joe, what diameter tubing is that made out of, and what is the spacing between those two vertical pieces of tubing? And is it rounded at the top where it folds over? Over to you, Joe.
This isn't made out of tubing. It's made out of solid material. I believe it's probably aluminum in construction, basic construction. The radials are aluminum, and so is the top element. They look like they're about at least 3/4, 3/8, maybe a little bit of the 3/8 diameter. They're not quite half inch. I guess 6/16, 5, maybe 7/16. A little less than half inch diameter on the radials on the top element. And the spacing between the top element, the piece that goes up and it's connected, it's actually fatter on one side than the other. That's about a 2-inch spacing between the top vertical radiating antenna itself, with the longest length being 50.3/8 inches from the tip of where it folds over to the longest part of the element, because the center part that's a little less in length is meant to couple onto a ceramic insulator to insulate it off the ground, and that goes to your center connector of your pigtail at the bottom of the antenna. Back to you.
Because those two vertical rods of this folded monopole are roughly 2 inches apart, in your estimation, close enough, and 7/16 diameter is at least one of those rods, and maybe the other one's a little bit skinnier or fatter, doesn't matter, that RF energy is mildly blind, it thinks that vertical radiator is a healthy 2 inches in diameter. It thinks it's a solid rod, 2 inches in diameter, very close to that. That's part of the reason why the antenna is a little bit more broadband. It's particularly the reason why the antenna is shorter than you think it should be. Remember what we were discussing last week during that hour and a half of Bill AC2IS. We were discussing copper foil antennas at 900 megacycles that are a half inch wide and roughly 6 inches long. So that's a 12-to-1 ratio of width to length, whereas a 80-meter dipole, for instance, made out of 14-gauge wire, the diameter to length is about a 4,000-to-1 ratio. So, as you can see, this is a very fat radiator, is what the RF energy sees, and that's part of the reason why it's considerably shorter Then a quarter wavelength. Let me drop them. But your main, remember the most important seven words in the vocabulary of an antenna designer or an antenna tuner is you resonate first, then it will radiate. So you choose whatever length is required to hit resonance, and resonance is defined as the reactive component disappears. You may have a resistive component that's too high or too low, but if the reactive component disappears, that's one of the main definitions of resonance. Because if the RF energy goes out to the antenna, then you know that all of it's not going to be reflected, or only a very small percentage of it gets radiated on the first pass. The majority of it hits the end of the antenna, reflects back. And whether that antenna energy reflects back and is in phase or out of phase determines whether or not you get reactance. If it arrives late, you call it inductive. If it arrives early because the antenna was too short, we call it capacitive reactance. And sure enough, it does act like a capacitor. And that's what your Victor network analyzer or your antenna analyzer would tell you. Let me drop. Now, ground plane radials, they should be, because they're a simple rod and they're not fat, they're going to be very close to a quarter wavelength long, but you could make them longer. If you've got enough of them, in the ideal world, the ground plane is an infinite sheet of metal. When you put some number of ground plane radials out there, you're really making a skeleton equivalent of a ground plane, which 90-some-odd percent of the time is good enough. In the case of HF antennas, because you're mounting it very close to Earth, and Earth, the ground in your backyard is a volumetric resistive material. And so any RF energy that gets coupled into it becomes lossy. And therefore you have to put down a whole lot of ground plane radials when it's a normal HF quarter wave ground plane mounted above Earth. Let me drop. In the case of this 6 meter ground plane like thing, quarter wave monopole, you're going to be mounting at some number of wavelengths in the air. It's not close to Earth. And therefore, as few as 3 radials in some cases is more than enough. Sometimes you only see 3 radials on the bottom of a station booster. And in many cases, that's more than enough. Because a little bit of the RF energy can sneak in between those 3 radials, but it can't go anywhere. It can't touch any lossy materials unless the antenna was laying flat on the ground. So I sense from your question, you wanted to know, why is the radiator shorter? We now discussed that. The 2-inch apparent diameter is that. Why are the ground plane radials almost a full quarter wavelength? We now know why that is. And the nice thing about this antenna is that the way it folds over and comes back to ground, it has a built-in RF choke to ground. Therefore, it could almost be struck almost directly with lightning without putting a great big impulse into your electronics. Let me drop. A significant number of people have built quarter wave ground plane antennas where the radiator is a simple quarter wavelength long, electronically speaking, piece of wire in the air connected to the center conductor of the coax cable. As a mobile antenna, that's a particularly risky thing to do because under certain weather conditions, you'll build up a significant amount of static charge on that radiator, even when it's mounted on a tower. Under certain weather conditions, you'll build up a significant static charge. If your radio has an RF choke to ground, then everything's okay. You'd be amazed how many radios the receiver has a simple coupling capacitor. And at first you'd say, gee, no DC is going to go through that into the rest of the electronics. That's a very naive way of looking at it. When static charge starts building up on an antenna, it can easily go to many thousands of volts. Within reason, no matter what you use as that coupling capacitor inside the radio between the transmission line and the first stage, no matter what you use for a coupling capacitor, there's a high probability the day will come along when the voltage will be high enough, you'll arc through that capacitor. At the time you arc through, you might have 5,000 volts on the antenna. And 5,000 volts charged on the sending conductor of your transmission line is a significant amount of DC stored energy in your coax cable. All of that gets dumped into that first transistor stage of your radio and can give you a lot of grief. So when in doubt, look at the schematic of your radio, look at the schematic of your antenna, make sure the antenna is DC grounded because Mother Nature just loves to put static charges on things that are up in the air. W2RYY for any further questions or comments. K2RYW, go ahead, Joe.
Okay. The radials, I also forgot to mention before, the radials are also horizontal. They're not grouped down 45 degrees like you'd find in a typical ground plane type of antenna, which is kind of interesting also. And you would think that, that's just a little unusual, but that's the way these things are constructed. But apparently because the radials are flat out horizontally and the antenna is shorter, it still presents a good 50-ohm impedance match to the transmission line. This antenna, according to the manufacturer, which is made by Decibel Products, I don't even know if they make this anymore, but that's who made the antenna. They claim the antenna has a 2% bandwidth on any of these low-band frequencies when it's cut for center frequency. Back to you.
2% of 50 megacycles is around 1 megacycle. And I think they're being conservative. Maybe their definition of bandwidth is where it doesn't exceed 1.7:1 or something like that. I think it should be a little bit more than 2% bandwidth. That's just my guess. In the case of a station master antenna, those three little radios are tilted down as a partial impedance matching device. If the radials went straight out, you'd have a slightly lower impedance. As they start slanting down, you have a slightly higher impedance. But they're still giving you a counterpoise action. In other words, the RF energy is something to push against when it comes to launching energy into that collinear radiator that's really a station master antenna. Let me drop it. In your particular case, where the antenna is mounted some number of wavelengths in the air and is not near Earth, as far as shielding characteristics from Earth is concerned, you don't have to have a whole lot of radials. And whether or not you make the radials tilted up slightly, flat out, parallel to the horizon, or tilted down slightly, is only an impedance matching device. The impedance goes a little bit higher. As you tilt the radials further and further down, eventually they become parallel to, the radials become parallel to the radiator. In that case, your ground plane has now just converted itself into a half-wave dipole, and you're feeding the center, and the coax cable is going down the center of the lower half of the dipole, if you know what I mean. So you get a little bit of a feeling of why the impedance goes up. The center of a dipole is more like 73 ohms. So the impedance goes higher as you tilt them down. So it sounds to me like you're pretty happy with the standing wave ratio. What did you have to do to adjust the length of the radiator? Because it is such a solid chunk of steel, 7/16 of an inch diameter, cutting and adjusting that length had to be a little bit of extra work with a hacksaw or a power tool. And in order to find out when the length is going to be right or wrong, you could have been holding tuning tools. Let me drop it. By having a piece of copper foil at the end of a long, thin stick, and you bring that close to the tip of this monopole while measuring standing wave ratio, you'll be adding capacitance to the tip of the antenna, tuning it to a lower frequency. So depending on whether or not the Biswag is better or worse, you know right away whether or not the antenna is too long or too short. It'll tell you right away which direction to go. If at worst, you had cut off too much metal, and you would have lost a lot of sleep over this one, all you'd have to do is take a chunk of aluminum and by whatever means, attach it to the top of that monopole, you'd be able to reestablish more length. And it would have very little change of the impedance of making it perfectly tuned as is, as opposed to making it too short and adding an extra top hat capacitor, if you know what I mean, Joe. So how did you do that tuning? And my guess is you had to do some pretty serious cutting of 7/16 of an inch diameter steel. To be 2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
The antenna is made of aluminum, not steel. And if you scale this down, where if you change the diameter to a third of the diameter of what the elements are measured for right now, approximately 7/16 or so, because they're definitely less than a half inch, but they're not quite a half inch. They look like more than 3/8, so between like 3/8 and half inch would be at something like, I guess, 7/16, give or take. If you scale that down, you could I believe in reality make the antenna work on 2 meters, and maybe you can make it out of tubing if you want to lighten the thing up. This happened to be a solid top element, but it's funny, one side of the top element is much fatter, and as it gets to the top, all of a sudden it changes to the smaller diameter, like 3/8 tubing, but the part that actually comes out to the center connector, that is about, let's see, 7/16, that looks like it's about, not 3/4, like about 5/8 diameter. Looks like about 5/8 diameter metal or aluminum that goes into the top porcelain insulator on the antenna. And then as it, just before it goes to the top and it joins this other piece of metal, which is much thinner, and then that bends around in a hairpin type of a loop, then goes back to the ground plate. But do you think if you scale this thing, if you shorten up the length by almost a 3-to-1 ratio and do the same thing with diameter, you could get something like this to work reasonably well on 2 meters? Back to you.
Absolutely, Joe. There's a universal law of antennas. Not only reciprocity, which I've always talked about, but if you scale every single dimension of an antenna proportional to the new wavelength you're going to, you'll get the exact same performance. There are people who have taken antennas on 80 meters and scaled them all the way up to 1296 and scale every dimension, and you get the exact same performance. I mean, the average person thinks that, hey, if I go one handband, I can stretch this idea of scaling. You can go from DC to light with that scaling factor. It'll absolutely work. And you might not even have to scale the diameters. If somebody gave you another one of those, and you don't feel like cutting it down in diameter, but you just shorten it enough to go on 2 meters, guarantee you would have under 2.5-to-1 standing wave ratio. And there's various ways you could put gimmick capacitors and gimmick inductors on that radiator to tune it so that the resistive component that maybe is going to start off on 2 meters at, let me pick a number, it might be 80 ohms, and you want to bring it down to 50 ohms. There's all kinds of ways you can put gimmick devices on the antenna to retune the capacitor, to retune the resistive component. So that would be a very interesting project. I wouldn't even change the all the dimensions of diameter. I would just change the length if I was building a 2 meter version of that, Joe. It would work like a charm. That sounds like a very rugged antenna. I am curious, the rod that comes back down and gets grounded, how is that mounted to the ground plane? Does it go through something like a hose clamp? Over to you, Joe, KQIW.
No, Dick, there's part of the ground plate is like, I guess, an add-on feature of an add-on piece of metal which goes up vertically. It's welded in one place. I think it is. I'd have to go find the ground plate for this thing. I misplaced that a while ago, but I have the antenna rod, but it's probably out in the garage someplace. I believe that's actually welded to the plate in one spot. And the antenna antenna ground radials are actually about 2 inches longer than it's supposed to be, because as you put these things through onto the lower side of the plate, they're actually being held on by U-clamps. They go on the top end of the plate, and the U-clamps go with the bolts facing down. But about 2 inches of each antenna rod for the ground radials are about 2 inches longer. So the length I gave you is the total length. If you subtracted the size of the plate, which is about maybe 2.5, maybe 3-inch square plate on each side, the radials might be 68 3/4. But I just brought up these numbers just to give you an idea of what this thing actually, how it's constructed on a 6 meter. Because somebody else asked me a while ago how to tune one of these things from a lower frequency on the commercial 30-50 megahertz band or 40-50 megahertz band up to 6 meters, and I gave them these dimensions, and I don't know if the guy ever put it into effect, but this is what I used. This is what I did many years ago with this, having access to a vector network analyzer. And I was able to look at the impedance on the Smith's part chart of the thing. I believe I got it fairly close to a 50 ohm impedance because I used the test cable right at the bottom of the antenna, and the antenna was about maybe 7-8 foot off the ground. The radio was about 7-8 foot off the ground. I had propped up on a wooden ladder, so I could cut the radios down, cut the top element down. It took quite a while. It took, you know, a good length of time to actually do this, but it was a fun thing to do because I never did it before, just to be able to have the test instrument capability of looking and watching what was happening as I was tuning the antenna, looking at the antenna's resonant frequency go up, and still trying to keep the impedance as close to 50 ohms as possible. Back to you.
Very fine. That's a very rugged sounding antenna. And when it comes to making the resistive component come out right, let's assume you're using your vector network analyzer. You hit resonance, which means that the Smith chart doesn't show you any positive or negative deflection representing inductive or capacitive reactance. But the resistor component turned out a little bit too high or too low. By way of the Brown and Woodward curves, when you look at the resistive curve of that Brown and Woodward curve, and the Brown and Woodward curve you'll find on either one of the websites I mentioned earlier, amateurradio.tangovictor or limoctechnet.com, you'll find the Brown and Woodward curves, and they're in Chapter 4 of every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook. There's two curves, two graphs. One graph is the resistive component, one graph is the reactive component of monopole-like antennas of various diameters and various lengths. When you look at the resistive component, you realize that you can make the resistive component anything from 1 ohm to over 1,000 ohms by adjusting nothing but the length of the radiator. The length of the radiator tells you the resistive component. Opposite of common sense. Let me drop. When you make the radiator shorter, you'll have less ohms. Make it longer, you'll have more ohms. So choose the right length that gives you the 50 ohms, and you can get it directly off of the Brown and Woodward curve if you want to, or you can do it experimentally. With your Smith chart or with your antenna analyzer, you know if the resistor component is too high or too low. Therefore, you make it longer or shorter. When you choose the right length to give you the resistive component that you want, which is probably 50 ohms, almost always there's a reactive component left over. It's not exactly resonant. And if it turns out to be capacitive, in other words, it's acting like it's too short, and you add a top hat capacitor on it, let me think about that now, that would be electrically adding length. Therefore, the resistive component will go up. Okay, there's other ways you can add capacitance. Down at the base, you can put a shunt capacitor or a shunt inductor. There's all kinds of ways you can put gimmick devices on the antenna to make the reactive component disappear. So the tuning procedure is a little bit less than common sense. The article by K2RIW on getting perfect impedance match of a dipole, and you'll find that article in limoctechnet.com. And I think it's also on amateurradio.tangovictor. That article gives you a lot of explanation of what I'm talking about. Let me drop. And by the way, a monopole is half of a dipole, so all the techniques that you use on a dipole to make the impedance perfect will work on a monopole. So you've done some of that already. So you've already done the tuning, you've already done the adjusting, you've already done the measurement. And so it's time to put that antenna in the air, because the magic band, when the sunspot cycle is not so desirable, the magic band is the one that opens periodically, Paul. Here we go, John. Here we go, Joe. And you can get a lot of fun with it. So how soon are you going to be putting that up in the air, Joe? W2RY.
Repeater, timeout.
W2RYY for the final. K2RIW.
Well, I have to just organize things just to find a place for it. I already have a pipe set up for that has a 450 beam on it. I could theoretically put something on top of that to make it work out okay. The funny thing I didn't remember, or the funny thing I remember about tuning the solar antenna, I would tune the top first, then it would bring the radio shorter. And what I noticed as I started approaching my center frequency of desire, as the radios were longer, the top element would move the resonant point as far as the vector network analyzer was looking at one frequency. But as I started with the ground plane radio longer than necessary, it would broaden out the response of the dip, but it wouldn't be as sharp. And as it started making them shorter, it didn't move the resonant frequency. It started decreasing the bandwidth, making the dip on center frequency a little deeper into the, you know, as far as return loads going. Back to you.
My recommendation, Joe, is to make the ground plane radials electrically exactly a quarter wavelength long. That way they act most like a short circuit, and they give you the least amount of RF energy flowing down the transmission line, the outside of the transmission line. Yes, you can use the radials, making them shorter and longer, to present an auxiliary inductor or capacitor. But when you're doing that, you're allowing RF energy to be on that outer shield of the transmission line. So I'd much rather see you do the tuning with the main center radiator, adjusting its length and doing gimmicky things with it to get the impedance right. I'd recommend you not use the ground plane radials. A little bit, yes. But if you use a lot of ground plane radio to establish resonance or reactance or tuning, then you're allowing RF energy to flow down past the ground plane radials, but past the counterpoise, and give you RF in the shack on the outside of the coax cable. It's not a showstopper, but it's the less desirable way to do that. Does that make some sense, Joe? K2LAW.
Trying to see if I had a, not a tape, but I had some measurements, so I'm just looking here momentarily. Because I had found a chart for this thing as far as cutting it. And even though, this is according to the manufacturer's chart. I'll give you an example. At 50 megahertz, these are their recommended cutting lengths. And you can work these backwards any way you want. I took two ends of the band, so you have some comparison. The chart, according to this manufacturer, at 50 megahertz, they're making the top element 55 and 7/8 inches long, and the radial, each radial 78 and a half inches long. At 30 megahertz on the nose, they're making the top element 90 inches long, and the ground plane radial is 127 inches long. So that's recommended by the manufacturer. So you know, and if you work out those numbers, they work out to be more than the ground plane radials work out to be more than a quarter wavelength at resonant at the desired frequency. Back to you.
Well, you think they're longer than the resonant frequency here, Joe, because of that great big plate in the middle where all the radials go into with those new bolts. That is a much less than inductive length, if you know what I mean. Any of the radial that's inside of that plate is almost not there. It almost doesn't count. So it's the amount of radial sticking beyond the plate that really counts as far as resonant frequency of the radials are concerned. When in doubt, you can hold your grid dip meter right against one of those radials, as close to the base as you can get it, and you'll find the resonant frequency of the radials. You might want to kill the resonance by whatever means of the main radiator to make sure it's not giving you any phony results. So you can measure the resonant frequency of the radials. And the closer they are to quarter wavelength electronically, where they hit resonance with your grid dip meter, you're going to get the most counterpoise effect, least amount of RF energy flowing past the ground plane radials and getting onto the transmission line outer conductor. Let me drop. Ordinarily, a folded dipole is a 300 ohm impedance antenna. If you build it in the conventional way out of, say, 300 ohm twin lead antenna wire. And with your larger diameter rods, it's going to be something like a 200 ohm impedance if it was a full half-wave dipole. Because yours is a quarter wave, only half of the half-wave dipole, of the folded dipole is there. If I'm correct in guessing that you would have been 200 ohms, the half of it's going to be exactly 100 ohms. So fed ordinarily, it's a 100 ohm antenna. As you make the radiator shorter, the resistive component goes down. That's what the Brown and Woodward curves are showing you. So you make it shorter than a quarter wavelength, it comes down from the 100 ohms of my guess, and it eventually gets to 50. Now you've got to reestablish resonance, and the way you reestablish resonance is by putting the top hat capacitor on. You didn't do that. You've got the folded over piece of metal at the top. That's a kind of a poor man's top hat capacitor. And your main radiator is tapered. That's another kind of top hat capacitor. The fact that it's larger in diameter near the center conductor of the transmission line and then tapers, that also adds electrical length without adding physical length. So you can see they did some very tricky things here to make the resistive component come out 50 ohms. I'm pretty sure those ground plane radios are very close to quarter wave resonant. And now you know how that thing was impedance matched by the Decibel Products Company, in my opinion. W2LYY, very crafty antenna. K2LIW in the tech net.
So what I've seen different people making comments, this particular antenna, it's been around for a long, long time. I think it was at least the probably mid-50s or early 50s. It's been in use for typical low-band, business-band installations. So this antenna's been around for a very, very long amount of time, and it's a very durable antenna. The only thing that breaks with it that somebody had told me after a length of time, the porcelain insulator eventually develops crack, and you can do a crack in it or two from just, you know, wind stress on the top element, depending on, you know, the length of it, if it's a little bit on the longer side. But the only physical, you know, detriment the antenna has, striking against it, so to speak. But other than that, the rest of the antenna is built fairly solidly, and it will handle at least 100 mile an hour winds. Well, I thought it was an interesting project, an interesting thing just to bring up as far as the subject goes, because people do like hearing about how antennas, how they construct different types of antennas and so forth. So back to you. I'm done with this, by the way.
Yeah, there's a lot to be learned from that antenna. It's been around for a lot of years because it's a rugged design with high performance. My guess is that antenna runs 99% efficiency. My guess is you could put a kilowatt into that thing and it would run ice cold. And the only slight vulnerability it has is because the main radiator is a tapered piece of aluminum that comes all the way down to something like 7/16 of an inch. When it reaches the porcelain insulator, that gives it a lot of stiffness, which gives it a lot of flexing of that porcelain insulator in a high wind condition. So that's the only vulnerability that the history of that thing seems to be demonstrating. And so there's various ways you could have stiffened the radiator, literally guying it with lacing cord so that it doesn't have the chance to swing back and forth. If you ran lacing cord somewhere up on the radiator down to the ground plane radioles so that it's guyed and doesn't want to swing back and forth, you would even protect that porcelain radiator, that porcelain insulator that could develop a crack. Good antenna. Thank you for that information. Jerry is next, N2 Charlie Victor Alpha. Jerry, last time when you signed in, your audio was quite low, your RF was quite weak, your signal was kind of noisy, so you're going to have to speak slowly, you're going to have to speak loudly, and squeeze the mic, wait a second before you start talking, because your transmitter doesn't pick up immediately. We always miss the first word. N2 Charlie Victor Alpha. Go right ahead, Jerry. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. Okay, maybe Jerry didn't hang in there. But Andy, N2HUH, he hangs in there. You wait and see. N2HUH, K2LAW. Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, well, it's easy for me to hang in there, Dick, because I just was harassing some of the guys on 160 meters, so... All right, I have two questions tonight, but the first one is if I were to put a horizontal loop around the perimeter of my house, 20 by 100 lot, so basically stay about 10 feet away from the power lines and or so, and I could put up a 200-foot long rectangular loop, or I could put up... just in the backyard, lucky to put up a 100-foot long loop. What I'm asking is, if I were to use the perimeter of my house, would I be setting myself up for some massive saturation of RF in my house? And basically, you know, RF all over the place and a lot of grief and a lot of nuisance. It may work. I don't know if it would work well, but it may work. But I might set myself up for a lot of problems. I guess I have to try it. Or should I stick to the looping just around the backyard and keep it away from the house by a few feet, and that's it? What do you think, Dick, N2H2H?
Okay, it sounds like you feel you have a limit of the number of acres of property and you want to make maximum use out of it. And this loop antenna, maybe you're on 160 or 80 meters and you need a lot of diameter. And it sounds like you think you're going to mount it fairly close to the ground, which is going to hurt the performance somewhat, and it's going to become a near vertical incident skywave antenna when it's a small number of wavelengths above the ground. And its efficiency is going to be a bit low, Andy, because you're going to be coupling quite a bit of RF energy into Mother Earth. There's a slight way you can get around this. There are loops and there are loops. Let me drop them. There is something called a DDRR, Directional Discontinuity Ring Radiator. Delta, Delta, Romeo, Romeo. Directional Discontinuity Ring Radiator, DDRR. You Google those words and find the right articles. You'll find a kind of loop antenna which really looks like as if you put a 600 ohm transmission line vertically stacked and you made a loop out of it. In other words, you take 600 ohm transmission line. Let's assume your loop is, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, 130 feet long. Your loop has got a circumference of 130 feet. And you take 600 ohm open wire line. Don't run it parallel to the ground, run it vertical, perpendicular to the ground. Make it into this circle that has a circumference of 132 feet in my example. Short it at one end, and at the other end, feed the two leads. That's a discontinuity ring radiator. There's a little bit more to it. But now, what's magic about that antenna is that you could call the upper wire of that open wire line, you could call that the radiator. The lower wire of the open wire line, you could call that the ground plane. So it's a kind of loop antenna with its own built-in ground plane. Let me drop. As such, the amount of energy it couples into the ground will be drastically decreased. It won't be zero, but it'll be drastically decreased, particularly if it can mount it a few feet above the ground. And the real radiation is now taking place vertically polarized between the upper and lower wire of the open wire line. And so I think the total amount of energy it would pour into your house is going to be less. You put a loop wire and feed a kilowatt of energy into it, I guarantee you're going to get some telephone interference, some radio interference, some television interference. Maybe even your fluorescent bulb in the kitchen will light up when you transmit. When you put the key down, the fluorescent bulb will get brighter. You'll get some of those RF effects. And there's ways you can cut that down a bit, particularly if your 60-cycle wiring happens not to have any resonant length along any of the XY direct, any of the north-south dimensions or east-west dimensions, the wiring of the house. As long as it doesn't hit resonance, you won't get the light bulb flickering, or, you know, lighting up with RF energy. But wherever possible, it is a lot nicer to take the main radiator of an antenna and keep it away from the living quarters. To wrap it around the living quarters, that's pushing your luck a little bit, but if you're smart enough, it can be done. DDRR is one of the ways. N2HUH. By the way, thank you for the photograph of John that you sent me. And I had a little trouble mailing a letter back to you. That's why you got two of them. My email system had a partial failure, and so I wrote the letter again, and all of a sudden it issued both of them. N2HUH, KQRIW in the TechNet, you've got it, Danny.
Okay, Richard, my pleasure. Not a problem. And, yeah, that's what I thought. I might make problems. You know, if I really have nothing better to do eventually, I'll try and watch all my lights blinking and everything and how turning on and off as I speak. I'll try URI, dear. That sounds good. That sounds like a worthy experiment. Well, in any experimental mood. And I'll do that. And the second